This is Economic Crisis, Unending War, and Right-Wing Resurgence with Noam Chomsky and Phyllis Bendis in Conversation, sponsored by Arlington United for Justice with Peace. The rest of the evening, Professor Chomsky and Phyllis Bendis commented on questions from the moderator, Charles Durber, author of several books on the capitalist global economic crisis and climate catastrophe. The speakers also responded to written questions from the audience. Noam was asked about the links between global issues and the domestic deficit.
I mean, one of the things, I completely agree with what Phyllis is saying, but so we can't have much of a debate, but there are some very straightforward things that have to be brought to people's attention, which you are not reading. I mean, we're supposed to be worried about the deficit. Actually, we probably shouldn't be worried about the deficit, but let's put that aside. Should be a deficit during a recession. But there's a deficit. Where's it come from? About half of it comes from military spending. Military spending is not for defense. In fact, military spending mostly is harming U.S. security. It's pretty easy to show that, in fact. But it's about the same as the rest of the world combined. So that's about half the deficit. Where's the other half? The other half is coming from the utterly dysfunctional healthcare system. The United States healthcare system is an international scandal. It's about twice the per capita costs of comparable countries. Outcomes are at the low end. 50 million people don't have health care, which is unimaginable in a rich country. If we had the same health care systems that they had in comparable industrial countries, and that's not a utopian ideal, we would not have a deficit. In fact, we'd have a surplus. Now, the Obama health care plan, whatever you think about it, maybe it improved things a little, did not touch this. It didn't touch it because to touch it would mean going after the centers of power in the United States, the financial institutions, the insurance companies, and big pharma. And Obama just gave all that away over enormous public opposition. The decision to let the U.S. is alone in the world, I think, in a legal requirement that the government can't negotiate drug prices. So, of course, drug prices are out of sight as compared with other countries. Actually, there's an exception, Veterans Administration. Government's allowed to do it there, so prices are comparable to other countries. Well, what does the population think about this? 85% disapprove, but there wasn't even an effort, not the slightest finger lifted to do anything about it. What about the rest of the healthcare system based on largely unaccountable private insurance, extremely expensive and inefficient? Well, there was for a long time, for decades, in fact, the public has been largely in favor of a national healthcare system. Okay, that wasn't even an option. There was a small residue of public option. The public was in favor of that by about 2-1. Government gave it away. We have to lavish care and attention on the financial institutions, the insurance companies, big pharma, and so on. So yeah, there's a deficit. That and the military are the sources of it. All of these are mobilizing techniques, but they have to be brought to people. You're not going to read them in the headlines.
Noam Chomsky speaking in Arlington, Massachusetts on February 10th, 2011. He was then asked to comment on the struggles for justice in Latin America and compare them with the Middle East.
Well, when you say that there's some commonality between the developments in Latin America and, say, the Middle East, I agree that that's true, but the consciousness and awareness of that has to go beyond the people sitting in this room and other scattered sectors elsewhere. That's certainly not the way it's perceived and understood. In fact, very few people even know what's happened in Latin America. And what's happened is as spectacular as what's going on in Tahrir Square right now. I mean, if you think about it, for 500 years, Latin America has been disintegrated. The countries are separated from one another. They don't unify, even road systems don't unify them. Integration is a prerequisite for independence. And so they've been colonized or neo-colonized. And furthermore, internally to each country, there's been something like what we're seeing in the United States now, except much more extreme. Vast misery and suffering, and pockets of extreme wealth and privilege, which are oriented toward the West. You know, you invest your money in Swiss banks, or you send your kids to European or US schools, you have a house in the Riviera and so on, but not investment for the population, for the country itself. Well, that's gone on for 500 years, not a small period of time since the Spanish and Portuguese explorers came. That's changed in the last 10 years for the first time. There are significant moves towards integration among the countries. There are efforts in a number of countries, including the biggest and most powerful of them, Brazil, including Argentina, Bolivia, Venezuela, Ecuador, there are in Chile, in fact, all over the hemisphere. There are efforts at least to address the scandalous internal problem of islands of extreme wealth with no responsibility to the country in huge pockets of misery. Well, that's a spectacular development. I think the demonstrators in the Arab world are aiming at something similar. Whether they can achieve it, well, you know, we don't know yet, but they're aiming at it and carrying it out very courageously. Sure, so that ought to be a linkage that's understood, and it ought to be meaningful to us. In Latin America, the countries have pretty much thrown out the United States. There are no U.S. military bases left in South America. In fact, the only major military base nearby on the continent is in Honduras, which is probably the reason why, one of the reasons why Obama broke with most of Latin America and even Europe in supporting the military dictatorship. It preserves a major military base. That's not yet the case in the Arab world, but they want them out, and it could happen. So yes, there's a potential linkage there, but the strong word is potential. It doesn't affect what happens here until people at least perceive it. And we're very far from achieving the state where people even perceive this.
I just wanted to say one other thing. I think that I really agree with you, Noam, that the linkage or the parallels between what's going on regionally right now in the Middle East is very parallel to the 1990s and the early part of the 21st century in Latin America. And of course, there's the irony of the post 9/11 wars, the so-called global war on terror, the GWAT. It's one of my favorite acronyms because it really sounds like what it is, you know, the GWAT. The GWAT has had one very interesting side effect, which was that the attention of the US military, major corporations, the war profiteers, and the media and how we were talking in this country was almost all focused on the Middle East and South Asia. And there just wasn't that much interference in what was going on in Latin America. And that was huge. That was huge. I mean, there is one other military base, of course, which is Guantanamo. But that's essentially a stolen base as opposed to a rented base, as we see in some other countries. But I think that what we're seeing is a very similar situation in the Middle East where the conditions are different in different countries. The division into nation states in the Middle East, of course, was much later than it was in Latin America. It didn't happen until 1922 in the main. Only Egypt and Iraq were the ancient nation states of that region. The rest were divided quite arbitrarily by the British and the French back in 1922 after World War I. But what you see as a result is that social movements do develop that are nationally specific. The demands are nationally specific. But the parallels and the ability to strengthen each movement, and then ultimately when you have independent governments, strengthen those governments based on each other. What we're seeing very powerfully right now with ALBA in Latin America, for instance, the Bolivarian coalition, if you will, that was designed to be an alternative to the OAS, with things like the Bank of the South, Telesur, the television nation of the South, this kind of South-South collaboration in the region and ultimately across oceans as well, becomes a very key part of what internationalism, I think, is going to look like. Nation states aren't going away, unfortunately. That is how the world is organized. But nation states are changing. We see right now with the vote in South Sudan, we're seeing the first African effort to create a new state and to redraw colonial boundaries after the Ethiopia-Eritrea war that went on terribly for many, many years. Other than that, there's been a sense in Africa that the colonial boundaries, as arbitrary and damaging as they are better left untouched because it will be worse. That may be rethought, I don't know, but I think what is going on continental bases, whether in Latin America, in Africa, now we're seeing it in the Middle East, is a sense of renewal of different kinds of ties between countries that is not rooted in kind of a spoken wheel idea that everybody's ties with each other has to go through the colonial power. So Egypt's ties with Jordan can only go through the US and Israel. Yemen's ties with Lebanon has to go through the US in some way. That's what's breaking down. And that strengthens both local governments, even though they are very repressive, and strengthens, more importantly, the social movements that are challenging them. So I think we're in for a very exciting period of internationalism. The challenge, again, for us is how do we build the consciousness of it here, and how do we bring it home so that we're part of that globally and not simply watching it and cheering it on?
Do you think the Egyptian model could be made viable here in light of the disarray of U.S. labor? Another way of putting that is there a way in which the current moment is reconfiguring not only the peace movement here, but the labor movement mm-hmm. here? And can we hope to see some sort of new linkage between the labor, peace, and environmental movements, given this new kind of systemic awakening that we might be on the bridge of here?
I think there absolutely has to be that kind of linkage. I don't think that the labor movement, I don't think it's a question of do we have to reconfigure the labor movement. The labor movement isn't what it was. It's never going to be because labor isn't what it was. Work in this country isn't what it was. Production in this country isn't what it once was. We've lost manufacturing and we're never getting it back. That ain't going to happen. So the question is, what are unions about? What kind of work do people do? It's different. And I think we're seeing that some with the changes in some of the unions are taking up the work of organizing the previously unorganized work, the work of organizations like the Day Laborers Organization in London, the National Day Laborers Organizing Network, the work of the Domestic Workers United, who are organizing nannies and caregivers and housekeepers, almost all of them immigrant workers, legal and illegal. That kind of organizing is going to be increasingly important. But I think that if we look to one sector or another sector and say, well, it's going to have to be the union movement that takes up what it means to build an internationalist movement, what it means to build a progressive movement in this country, it's not going to happen. This country's population has been incredibly divided from ourselves. We have to recreate that. But that's why we need movements that overlap with each other. And that's why I was saying I don't think our primary goal should be to rebuild the kind of peace movement that we saw during the Bush years. That movement was extraordinary. How many of you were in the streets on February 15th, 2003, the day the world said no to war? Interesting. I would have thought more, but okay, a lot of you were. 14 million people around the world were in the streets that day in 665 cities all around the world. It was an astonishing moment when the pressure could not have been higher on the Bush administration, on everything else that we did. And although we didn't stop the war, we didn't prevent the war, but it's a huge mistake to say that that movement failed, that that demonstration failed. It accomplished all kinds of things, including having to do with our own movement. But we're in a different political moment. People view the White House differently. And, you know, it's fine for us to have our own critique of Obama and say what isn't different and that there's more similarity than distinction between the Obama foreign policy and the Bush foreign policy. That's all important work. We need to do that analysis. But we also have to keep in mind that the White House isn't what it was when Bush lived there. That around the world, people don't see Barack Obama the way they saw George Bush. They are fundamentally disappointed in Barack Obama because he made promises he has not kept. He made one promise he has kept. He promised to escalate the war in Afghanistan. He told us he would, and he did it. That was the promise kept, not a promise broken. But around the world, there is not that kind of view that the resident of the White House is a war criminal and should be brought up on trial in The Hague. That's not what the world is like, and that's not what people in this country are seeing either. So we need to think of new ways of organizing, and that's what I was saying when I think that we need a broader movement, of which the peace movement is going to be one small part. Among many, among people who are working on labor rights, immigrant rights, children's rights, the environmental justice, all of those questions, jobs, housing, education, those are the issues that are at the root of people's problems today, not the war. The war is not the centerpiece of what people think of when they see the problems with their government. And we can talk all we want about what they should see, but every good organizer knows you don't start with where you want people to be, you start with where people are. That's the kind of movement that we need to build, and it's not going to be easy.
So I'm just going to ask Noam to comment briefly on his view of the current political configuration in the United States. And a number of questions did raise one of the title themes of this presentation, which is the resurgence of the right wing in the United States, the Tea Party. So in the current context, you see this kind of excitement on parts of the left about a new democratic moment. And at the same time, people are scared about the rise of right-wing populist movements. So I'm going to just ask Noam to comment on how he sees the current political configuration, both right and left in the United States, and what kind of openings exist for a new kind of integrated progressive movement in the United States, given all the challenges on the right as well.
Well, the challenges on the right are real. We should pay careful attention to what they are. Take, say, the Tea Party. It's a small part of the actual Tea Party, is a small part of the population, maybe 15%. Fairly affluent, almost all white. Nativist, comes from an old nativist tradition of, it's now intensified by the recognition on the part of a large part of the population that the white population in the United States is going to become a minority. In fact, they're on the verge of becoming a minority. So that leads to the sense that somebody's taking away from us what we have and we own. That increases the old-fashioned and extremely ugly nativism that goes way back. That's a small part of the population, but about half the population is sympathetic to it, and that's not a small part of the population, and it's not affluent. It's the people who are suffering, the people whose in real incomes have stagnated for 30 years, majority of the population, and whose working hours have shot up, whose benefits have gone down, and they were never very much, and they're angry. And however, if you look at their actual attitude, so these are the people who say, let's get rid of the healthcare program, or let's make the government, cut down the size of government, get the government off our backs, and so on. That's what the headlines say, but take a look at the actual attitudes. These very same people, this is a very heavily polled country. A ton of political science research goes into trying to find out exactly what attitudes are, and they're very revealing. The same people who are saying, get the government off our backs, are saying, increase spending for health, for education, for help to the poor, but not welfare. They're against welfare, but they're in favor of helping mothers with dependent children. Why not welfare? Well, because they're in the thrall of this, Reaganite hysteria about black welfare mothers driving to the offices and Cadillacs to take our hard-earned money. So we don't want welfare, but we do want help for the poor. And that's across the board. I mean, even foreign aid. People are strongly against foreign aid. They say we're giving everything away to those undeserving people out there. When people are asked what they think foreign aid, what part of the budget it is, They give some astronomical figure. When they're asked how much of a percentage of the budget should it be, they give a figure which is far higher than it actually is. In fact, across the population, without going into details, attitudes are kind of social democratic, sort of New Deal style liberalism. Those are the attitudes among the population. But it's not showing up. And it's not showing up because of the failure of the left to mobilize it. Now, in the past, the cutting edge of mobilization has been the labor movement. Go back to the 1930s, Great Depression, I'm old enough to remember it. What was exciting and what was organizing people was organization of the CIO, sit-down strikes, which terrified the business world. Sit-down strike is one step before taking over the factory and saying, we don't need the managers, which is true, but you don't want that recognition to get in. Well, that's not happening now. There has been a tremendous attack against the labor movement starting right after the Second World War, enormous in scale, and it's been pretty successful. As I mentioned, a lot of it has been flatly illegal. The government simply announced since the Reagan years it's not going to apply the labor laws. The result has been very striking. The attack on public service unions now, right in front of our eyes, is the last part of this, an effort to get rid of the last piece of a labor movement, which could be a counterweight to these developments and a center for this kind of mobilizing. Unless the labor movement is reconstituted as an organized militant force, I think it's going to be really hard to develop the kind of movement that Phyllis is rightly talking about. And there are things that can be done, even very concretely. So like, take, say, right here in Boston. A couple of months ago, there was a major strike in Taunton, a town near here. A multinational corporation decided to close down a plant and move somewhere else. The plant's perfectly profitable, but it doesn't make enough money for the multinational. The union, UE, and the community tried to get together to buy the plant. Well, the multinational would make more money if they sold the plant than if they just dismantle it, but they prefer to dismantle it. That's normal, happens all over the country. The multinationals are class conscious. It's a class conscious business class. They don't want to establish the possibility in people's minds that they can take over things and run them themselves. So it's better to lose money than to allow this to proceed. Well, I don't know the exact outcome at the moment, but it's not going to succeed unless there's public support. And there can't be public support unless there's some knowledge of it outside the people who read the UE newsletter. And it could succeed. And that could succeed in many places. When Obama took over the auto industry, basically the government owned most of it for a while, there were several plant possibilities they could pursue. One was to reconstitute it so it could be handed back to the old management and they could make profit and the banks could do fine and so on, which is what was done. So plants were closed, work was shifted off to overseas and so on, and finally trimmed down enough so they can make money. Another alternative was for the work for the so-called stakeholders, the workforce and the community to take it over. Would take some government support. There are things it could do. Those plants that are being dismantled could be used, and the skilled workers could be used to produce things that the country really needs, like high-speed rail or green technology. And there's no reason why it should all go on in China and Spain and so on. Could go on here, but that's going to require a real commitment. If we're going to have a movement of the kind that Phyllis is talking about, those particular actions all over the place will have to be a core part of it. And they're not, pie in the sky. They're right in front of us constantly.
Just a quick thing. I think that this question of how we need to build a movement, Noam's point I think is exactly right. There are small campaigns in various places, the work to build cooperative production in places like Cleveland, and Cincinnati are underway. The work for conversion, you know, it doesn't take that much technology to convert a manufacturing plant from manufacturing bombers to manufacturing solar panels. You know, the same workers can do the same work. You just need to reconfigure the plant. It takes maybe a year and you're good to go. So those are possibilities, but it's this question of mobilization and engagement. And that's one of the things that I think we have to look at very carefully. Noam is right when he said we have to look at what the right has done in this country. The Tea Party movement captured a kind of populism that once we used to capture. And we need to get them back. There is racism that is rampant in the Tea Party movement. But there is also a very real and legitimate sense of class pressure and class oppression. These are people who have lost their jobs. They're turning on people of color because it's convenient. It's easier to turn on people of color and blame them than to hold the government responsible, because you can deal with that on a one-to-one basis. We haven't done very well in reaching people who are facing that. The mobilization of October 2nd of this past year was one example I think is something to build on. It was flawed in all kinds of ways. This was no great accomplishment. But what was huge about it was this was a demonstration that was the first time in a generation, the first time in 18 years that you had labor and the civil rights movement and some peace components and some environmental components coming together to say things have to change, things have to be different. We didn't get everything we wanted. The peace movement had a seat at the table. We didn't get very much. We didn't get a speaker who was a designated speaker to represent the peace movement. But what do you know? There was Harry Belafonte who played that role and was brilliant in doing it. And what was extraordinary, and it's not just because my friend Harry is one of the best speakers around, it's because people agreed with it. When he talked about the cost of war and how that the cost of that escalation in Afghanistan could pay for hundreds of thousands of green jobs back at home, there was an enormous wave of applause that swept that crowd. That was because they got it. They needed somebody to say it. So we have that connection, and we have to make real, we have to build on that. We have to figure out how to do it better, how to link the work that's going on to rebuild the economy with the mobilizations to support a new kind of economy that isn't based on war. It's really hard, but that's the work we have to start.
You are listening to comments by Noam Chomsky and Phyllis Bendis in Arlington, Massachusetts, in conversation on issues of economic crisis, unending war, and right-wing resurgence. They were also asked to comment on language and propaganda. Noam Chomsky took this question first.
I actually don't think there's anything very profound to say about this, and you don't have to know much about language. It's kind of on the surface. Everything that's understood about these matters is on the surface. Anyone can figure it out. So take, say, the huge military budget. In 1947, those of you who are old enough will remember, there was a change in the terminology used with regard to the military system. Up till 1947, we had a War Department. In 1947, it was changed to a Defense Department. Now, anybody with a gray cell functioning knew that from that point on, the United States would never be involved in defense again. It would only be involved in aggression. That's why you're going to call it a Defense Department. When it was honest, like we were exterminating the indigenous population, conquering the Philippines and so on, fighting the Second World War, then it was a War Department. But now we're in a new world. We're nothing to defend ourselves against. We have overwhelming power. It's going to be a Defense Department. And that happens all over the place. Take, say, the Israel-Palestine confrontation. That's the way it's described here. It's not what it is. What it is a U.S.-Israel versus the world confrontation, literally. And it's been that way for 35 years. You can see it in UN votes. Right at this moment, there's a vote, suppose there's a resolution in the Security Council brought by Lebanon calling for a resolution which would condemn the expansion of settlements in the occupied territories. Theoretically, that's US policy. But in fact, the US has made it very clear that if the resolution goes through, it's going to veto it. And that's going to be the US versus the world. A similar resolution in the General Assembly, I forget the numbers, what was it, like 185-3 or something like that. I mean, that's the usual vote. All right, as long as all discussion is presented as a matter of the US, an honest broker, trying really hard to bring two recalcitrant sides together, we might as well not talk about it at all. The discussion is just, you know, off in outer space. Until it becomes a discussion of the US versus the world, the US and Israel versus the world, which is exactly what it is and has been for years, you're not going to have a rational discussion. And we can generalize this to case after case. Take, say, what's going on right now with regard to Ronald Reagan. That's really an impressive example of propaganda of the kind that literally would have impressed Kim Il-sung. When Reagan left, it's not a joke, and it's worth thinking about. When Reagan left office, he was the most unpopular living president after Nixon. He was more unpopular than Carter. And he left office. He's after that started an amazing propaganda campaign, the Reagan legacy, which turned this creature into something semi-divine. Literally the case. He's now presented as the person, I mean, and it's bipartisan, you know, like Obama describes him as a transformative figure and so on. He's supposed to have shown that what we have to do is cut back the size of government, let the free market run, be fiscally responsible and so on. I mean, look, he increased the size of government. He was the most protectionist president in post-war American history. He was fiscally so irresponsible that the country changed from the world's leading creditor to the world's leading debtor, left the country with the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. It's all been totally, and I won't even talk about the horrors overseas, it's all been completely inverted. And it's succeeded. It's our fault that it succeeded. It's an amazing propaganda campaign. It's being celebrated right now. And it succeeded because we let it succeed. These are just scattered examples. You can continue on and on. It requires no sophistication about language to see what's going on. It just requires understanding of elementary propaganda techniques, which work. They do work if they're not countered. And the task is to counter them.
Let me respond to in one other way, though. I think that we have seen before, and we're seeing right now, the opportunity for using some of these examples in another way. And I'm speaking particularly about this issue of democratization. That was, of course, the basis on which George Bush took the world to war in Iraq. But at the same time, and one of the things we're seeing right now, there's a weird move of some of the neoconservative supporters of the war in Iraq who are supporting the protesters in Egypt, breaking with Israel, some of them, because they see it as part of this expansion of democracy, which they claim is their own. Now, they can claim what they want, but the bottom line for us, it seems to me, is that this is an opportunity to educate people around the issue of hypocrisy and double standards in US policy. Because democracy is something that we should claim as our own. That should be what we want. That's what the people in the streets of Egypt are calling for right now. And look at what the history has been of the US when it really comes to democratizing places like the Middle East. Look what happened with the elections in the Palestinian territories in 2005 and 6. You had the elections that people at the time claimed were the freest and fairest in the Arab world. I'm not sure that's true, because I don't think you can necessarily have free and fair elections under military occupation. But nonetheless, they were, in the technical sense, apparently quite free and fair. To the surprise of pretty much nobody except Condoleezza Rice, who was shocked to see that Hamas had support, Hamas, the bad guys, the guys we didn't want to win, won the election. And so what do? We don't say, well, sorry, but, you know, people win. Sometimes your candidate wins, sometimes the candidate you don't like wins, and you have to deal with it because that's democracy. No, what we saw was an immediate collective punishment imposed on people in Gaza. Hamas had won in the West Bank also, but not by as big a margin. But in Gaza, immediately, collective punishment imposed in the form of a siege that continues in different forms to this day. So the question is, well, where's the democracy here? It's democracy when the result is what we like, when it's a bad result, and you heard it around Egypt when Hillary Clinton said, we're not going to support a democratization process that leads to a form that might be oppressive in the future. Who do you think she was talking about there? You know, so by saying, well, we're not going to support anybody that lets the Muslim Brotherhood come into power, whatever we might think of the Muslim Brotherhood isn't really very relevant. We don't live there. It's not our country. It's not our call. But she seems to think it's her call. So I think that this is a very important opportunity for us to show what real democratization and respect for other countries' democratization processes are really all about.
Moderator Charles Durbin then asked the presenters, Noam Chomsky and Phyllis Bennis, to compare the activism of today to that of the Vietnam War era. What was similar and what was different? Phyllis took this question first.
I think it's a hard question. I think certainly there are objective reasons, and the draft was by far the biggest single component of what created a youth-oriented movement at that time. The fact that students were not immune from the draft except in certain circumstances, etc. But it's also what it means to be in college now. It's far fewer people can go to college. It's more expensive. It's harder to get scholarships. They're not available, partly because of cutbacks in education funding. People are working two jobs while they're in school and coming out of school with huge debts. So the question of feeling like you have to use every minute to really study because otherwise you're never going to be able to get out of debt, I think is it's a fear factor for students. That was not true for my generation. I spent my time organizing far more than going to classes. I didn't get a degree as a result, and you know, I sort of didn't care. I wouldn't recommend that to anybody now, because it's not so easy. You know, it's just the economic situation is so much harder for students among others. People have had to grow up much quicker and realize that financially, having a college degree isn't a guarantee of anything, and it's harder to be there. So it's harder to go outside of what you're doing day to day. I think the one other thing has to do with how people see their own position in the world. I think there's been a very successful kind of propaganda of disempowerment. Part of it is we define movements these days too much, I think, as can we get 100,000 people in the streets? It's important to do that sometimes, and we should certainly still try sometimes, but I think it's a big mistake to define that as the definition of a powerful movement. One of the things I learned from Noam years ago that I think I've used more than most things that I've, more often than other things that I've learned from Noam, is the difference between the war in Vietnam and its anti-war movement and the anti-war movement around Central America, where the protests were smaller, but it was much more in the church, in the PTA, in the school, in the family. It was more endemic to American society as a whole, less part of a fundamental divide that was partly a cultural divide and a political divide. Where you stood on the war in Vietnam determined everything about how you lived your life. That wasn't necessarily true of the wars in Central America. The anti-intervention movement was a different kind of movement. It wasn't as visible. It didn't have hundreds of thousands of people in the streets and campuses ablaze all over the country. But it did have a much more organic tie to a lot more people. And that's important. And I think one of the conclusions for me, of that is that this may well be a time when national mobilization is not as important as local mobilization. We need to be looking at alternative centers of power, not only Congress, but the local city council resolution saying, we want our tax money home, we want to spend it here in Boston and not have it sent off to an unwinnable and illegal war in Afghanistan.
One thing that we ought to think about carefully is exactly what the facts are in this case. I mean, there was a substantial, very visible anti-war movement which brought a million people to Washington and so on for about 4 years. And it's really 1967 to 1971. Those of you who lived in Boston in those years will remember, perhaps, that we didn't even dare to have a public demonstration against the war until October 1965 on the Boston Common. At that time, there were hundreds of thousands of American troops rampaging in South Vietnam. The country had been practically destroyed. The war had expanded to the rest of Indochina. That meeting was broken up, and it was broken up by students. I remember I was supposed to be one of the speakers. None of the speakers could speak. And it was praised in the counter-demonstrations were praised in the Boston Globe the next day. That was October 1965, okay? And this is a liberal city. Charlie mentioned the women's movement, which is probably the popular movement that had the most effect on the society. But that wasn't the 60s. I mean, the seeds were laid in the 60s, but it really took off in the 70s and the 80s. The Central American movement, which was totally different from the anti-war movement, it wasn't just students in elite universities, it was in churches in the Midwest and the Southwest, and you know, thousands of people going to help. Nobody ever dreamed of going to live in a Vietnamese village to protect people and to help them. In fact, that had never happened in the entire history of imperialism. It did happen in the 80s with many thousands of people, and many of them stayed. My daughter, for example. And the global justice movement, that's the last 10 years here. I mean, it started much earlier in the South, but it became a major movement here. The demonstrations against the Iraq war, right before the war, that's the first time in the history of imperialism that there were massive public demonstrations against a war before it was officially launched. It actually had been going on, but not officially. And it had an effect. The U.S. could never begin to do in Iraq what Kennedy and Johnson had done freely in Vietnam, because there was no opposition. My feeling is there's more activism now than there was in the 60s. Except for a very brief period, very narrowly focused. What Phyllis said about the debt is very crucial. You take a look at elite circles, they were petrified about the 60s, not just the student movement. It was that people were getting organized, active. There was what was called a crisis of democracy. Normally passive people are pressing their own demands, minorities, students, beginning of women and others. That was terrifying, and you had to beat it back. And starting in the early 70s, there was a massive attempt to beat it back. A large part of it was aimed at the universities. You go back to the liberal internationalists, kind of people in the Carter administration. What they wrote about publicly was the failure of the institutions responsible for the indoctrination of the young. The schools, the universities, and the churches, they were not carrying out indoctrination of the young properly. The young people were too active and so on. And things had to be done about it. Well, one of the things that had to be done was sharply raising tuitions. That's the time when tuition started to go sky high. I mean, it's now at the point where for most of the country, funding of higher public education, so the public universities, is more of it is coming from tuition than from the state. It's a total scandal. You go to a poor country like Mexico, they have a free public education, higher public education system. It's not a pretty good one, poor country. It's not an economic necessity, it's part of a system of indoctrination and control. You come out of school with a $50,000 debt, you're not free. The 60s, to say Phyllis's generation, kids could do what she was doing because it was still a period of economic growth. It was a sense, look, I can I can leave school for a couple of years and organize and act, and when I'll go back in, I'll still have a life. There's not that feeling now, because it's not true. First of all, you're coming out with debt. Secondly, you're going into an economy that's designed to benefit an extremely small sector, not most of you. And that has a disciplinary effect too. Nevertheless, I think if you actually count noses, there are probably more young people now active in one thing or another than there were in the 60s, except for a very brief and narrowly focused period. And I think that's encouraging.
I wanted to say just one quick thing, but one of which is that I was around at the end of the 60s, just so we're clear. But I think that what Noam just said is very crucial, that it's that people are more active than we realize. And I want to give just one example that I think is very important. I spend a lot of time on the road speaking at campuses and at community events. And one of the things I find almost everywhere is that when I go to a campus, their view is that the city that their campus is located in, there's nothing going on. There's nobody doing stuff against the war. There's nobody doing stuff against the Israeli occupation. When I go to a city and do something in town, they say, oh, the students here, nobody's doing anything. And it turns out that in both, there are plenty of people on campus and in town, and they don't talk to each other. So there's a huge town-gown divide that exists in our movements, in our social movements, working on the same issues in the same cities. So to the degree that we can get that together and do, for example, a campaign around military spending focused on the Boston City Council. What about a resolution that, you know, brings up the questions of the costs of war in Afghanistan and how that's playing out right here with the kinds of cutbacks we need to see in the cities? That involves both students and people in the community, and it's a way of convincing ourselves that people are really in motion in a way that isn't always visible. And I think we're supposed to go to this other thing now.
Okay, could we give a good
round of applause? I'm so glad I got to see you.
That concluded the formal presentation for the evening. Part of the purpose for this event was to bring people together to start working on solutions to some of the issues raised in conversation. Several workshops ensued. Phyllis Bennis helped organize this portion.
Talking about what we need to do is only the preliminaries. Step one is when we get together and exchange emails. That's step one. So that's going to be part of what we do tonight. The four areas: bringing the war dollars home, what I was talking about earlier, alternative centers of power, the question of immigration, and again, linkage. What does it mean that the DREAM Act is going to be on the agenda, maybe in a different way? Can we get a DREAM Act that doesn't demand that people go into the military as an alternative, but has some kind of public service? What are the options? What are the possibilities? And how do we in the peace movement support the DREAM Act as it stands? And then connecting the issues of peace and the environment. Again, what causes wars these days? It's not about land alone, it's about resources. Why do we need resources? Because we have an environmentally unsustainable world in the West and in the North that is dependent on oil. So what do we do about that? How do we link those things? If we were not dependent on oil, we wouldn't have wars in oil-rich countries. We'd have wars in broccoli countries, except we wouldn't have to have wars because we can grow broccoli anywhere. So, you already said where each one goes? No. Okay, so here's what we're gonna do. Number one, fund our communities, bring the war dollars home, is gonna be back in that corner, okay? Somebody, who's going to that one? Raise your hands. Red shirt right there. She's going to lead you to that back corner on fund our communities, bring the war dollars home. Immigration and immigrant rights struggles, who's going to that? Okay, you're Nancy Murray, you're going to be in the back corner right over there. And connecting the peace and environmental justice movements, who's going to that one? Woman in Black, right here. People that want to self-organize other groups in the outside room here. Key is, don't think you have to get everything done now. Exchange names, figure out how you're going to communicate and what the issues are going to be, and then we're done for the evening. Thank you all.
Economic Crisis, Unending War, and Right-Wing Resurgence, an organizing event sponsored by Arlington United for Justice with Peace, took place at the Pleasant Street Congressional Church in Arlington, Massachusetts on February 10, 2011. Featured speakers were Professor Noam Chomsky and Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies. Your host, Chuck Frazina, recorded this program. Thanks for listening.